Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome to this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here. I'm your host, and we got lots to talk about. This is the virtual guest-o-rama. What does that mean? Well, we got lots of guests that weren't invited and never agreed to come on, but we're going to talk to them anyway. We got Jamie Dimon. We got Lashman Altshuler from ECRI. Mark Faber is going to talk to us from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report, and Art Cash, and a lot. We're going to be talking about JP Morgan. We're going to be talking about China. We're going to be talking about Facebook IPO. We got lots to go over today. And all this is coming up on this episode, number 263 for May 14th, 2012. So what I thought we'd do today is something a little bit different. We're going to have some guests on that I wanted to hear, but they were not easy to book, so I thought what we'd do is just grab them from other interviews and kind of talk to the discussion that they're having, because some of the things on the list that we all want to know about is what's going on with JP Morgan, what's happening with the economy, you know, and what's happening with Europe. So we're going to kind of get into that discussion and also answer some questions that I have from some listeners that came in. We had a barrage of questions on a couple different topics and some things that I want to go over with you. So thank you for sending those to me. And of course, you could always send me something at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Boy, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, a lot of things have been happening. The economy seems to be slowing down. We saw that with the jobs numbers last week. We saw a lot of the manufacturing starting to come down. Interestingly enough, consumer confidence that came out with the University of Michigan preliminary survey from May came out much better than expected, which gave a little bit of a lift, initially at least, to the markets. But did you notice that last week we saw this really, kind of wonky move on markets where we'd get either a flush down and then almost a V dramatic move up towards the end of the day to either break even or come close to even? Or like we saw on Friday, we saw a kind of a move up and then just a V inverted down so that the market finished off on the S&P by about 5 points or so. It's kind of an interesting situation. You have a battle between the bulls and the bears, a couple of very important and key resistance and support zones that are occurring right now on the markets. And that's kind of one of those times where you're going to find those choppy markets, very difficult to navigate. And in a way, you want to be either away from it or somewhat hedged to it. We have some puts on our portfolios, S&P 500 puts for the on the SPY. We have some short on the small caps right now. We have a couple of key positions short. And we've whittled down our portfolio, thinned it out over the last several weeks so that we have some key positions that we really want to hold and that we think will do well. And if they don't, of course, we'll kind of start bringing them down as well. And we've added to some that look like they're inherently going to break out. As a matter of fact, one that we did add to our biggest position, and that was fortunate, was Monster Beverage. That, speaking of a monster, came out with great earnings last week and a great outlook. And that's good because when you see the opposite happening, stocks have been tumbling. Look at Fossil, Tempur-Pedic. Look at Green Mountain Coffee Roasters as an example. Look at what happened with Herbalife last week. Although we think that's kind of a little bit overdone right now, but still you have to be very careful because you never know when the selling is going to actually either stop or continue and get much more intense because a lot more people are unloading a stock they have no faith in. And remember something. I think this is really important, and it's something I've been talking to a few of my colleagues about. You see that in the markets that the general volume has been really slowing down over the last couple of years, and in particular this year, volumes have been slowing down again. And that leaves a very precarious zone. Because when things are good, they pop. Why? Because there's not a lot of players that are really working on that side of the equation. So there really are no sellers. But then again, there's no buyers on the markets when times are tough. And that's why you see those big drops. I call them long tails. Long tails. You see those candle patterns on a chart? We see the very fine wicks on the bottom, long tails, and then they pop up towards the middle of the day. For example, they maybe sell off really abruptly in the morning and then come back. Those are things to look at if you can find those that have the tails that are close to very important support points, and you have to obviously figure out where those are. But if you can figure out where those are, some great profitable bounce opportunities are there. As a matter of fact, last Friday, we had an all-day open for our subscribers, actually, a bounce-a-thon, so to speak, where we had throughout the day coming up with ideas which may bounce. There's about three or four of them. One of them was GNC Holdings, as an example. And GNC Holdings is a natural food store. And basically, we put a bounce alert on it, then a breaking up alert through Trigger Points Research. And what happened was that GNC was actually up about, I think, close to 10% in a week. There are those opportunities out there for both breaking up and breaking down. And you have to be really careful in your portfolio, because when you see the volume start to come in on any particular issue, you have to say, hey, wait a minute, is this something I'm willing to hold because I like the fundamental outlook and I like the outlook for the markets and I like the technicals on it? You have to combine all three. If all three don't work together and they're not consistent, you could have a problem on your hand. And there's nothing worse than all of a sudden having a stock that you love to death and you hold it onto, and all of a sudden the thing drops, you know, 20-30% on you, and then you have a long way to climb back. So right now, it's kind of like take some profits on positions, get ready to pounce on them back if, in fact, markets do turn around to a more friendly type of environment. But with all the things that are going on right now in the markets when it comes to Europe, when it comes to China, which did, in fact, reduce their reserve requirements by another 0.5% over the weekend. We'll see how that plays out next week. And when you see a lot of these things all coming together at the same time, and add to that the fact that you have a fiscal cliff at the end of this year, you know, you have the recipe, you have the ingredients for some really bad moves on positions that on one hand you could take advantage of if you want to be aggressive. On the other hand, you may want to take some profits if they had a nice run for the last however long it is. So what I thought we would do is let's get to some of this guest-o-rama as we talked about, and then we'll get to some questions that you had, and I'll answer those. And I thought we would start with an interview with Mark Faber from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom report that was done on Bloomberg this week. And then we'll talk a little bit about what he has to say. And particularly, he was talking about Europe, and he's talking about really who should stay and who should go. Take a listen.
Now, the tremors from Europe, as he was just talking about, being felt all over the world, especially here in the United States. We're joined by the always outspoken Mark Faber. He's the editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom report. Mark, weigh in. Do you believe that that Greece will have to exit the euro eventually?
Well, I think there is a very good chance that it will exit the euro, and I think it would have been desirable if the euro countries had kicked out Greece already 3 years ago. It would have saved a lot of agony rather than to bail it out, and as a result of the bailout, the problem has become bigger and bigger and bigger.
So, if it does have to exit, do you believe that the policymakers have what it takes to manage this exit properly, Mark?
Look, I think it would be much better for Greece and for actually the entire euro area if Greece were kicked out, Spain was kicked out, Italy out, and even France out. At the end, you just have Germany with the euro. That the other countries can have their own currencies and still trade and use the euro as an international currency.
So, Mark, let me just re-ask you that question that I heard earlier when you had said, you know, it looks like eventually Greece will have to exit the euro. Do you think the policymakers have what it takes to manage that exit properly?
Yes, you see, the bureaucrats in Brussels and the media, they're brainwashing everybody that if Greece exited the euro, it would be a disaster and so forth. But my view is the best would be actually to dissolve the whole eurozone, and that the countries would go back to their own currencies and still use the euro.
as an international currency, the way, say, you travel through Latin America with a dollar, you can pay anywhere you wish. And so that, in my view, would be the best. And then these countries that have financial difficulties, you just have to write off their debts and then make it difficult for them to access the capital market in future. Just to keep on bailing them out is going to increase the problem. It's not going to solve the problem.
Now, what's interesting about that, what I thought was interesting was that he talks about how we should kick out everybody, right? Kick out Italy, France, kick out Greece, kick out Portugal, Spain, and leave Germany just the only one in the euro, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, how could you leave Germany the only one? I mean, a better way would be leave everybody in the euro and Germany should extract itself and just go back to, their own currency. The Deutschmark, I don't know. There was something a little strange about that because it doesn't seem like that would be worthwhile. Because if you do that, what's going to happen is you're going to weaken the euro dramatically or at least strengthen it, depending on how you want to do it. Because what happens is if all the weak countries come out of it, the blended rate of the euro, which is based on the, we'll call it the stability and the strength of the countries that are in it, are really bent towards France and Germany, and in particular Germany. Now, if that weighting of Germany comes out, what's going to happen is the euro plummets. And the German currency, whatever they're with on their own, skyrockets because they're very strong and they're, you know, safe. And as a matter of fact, their 10-year bond went to the lowest rate ever in history just last week. So how is it that that would work? It doesn't seem very practical. And if you do, in fact, take the others out, they're going to benefit dramatically. So there's something a little strange about that. And let's talk about the euro because I got some questions about this. Is the euro good to short at this point? Well, my answer was a lot of people have been trying unsuccessfully to do so for some time because whether it's a magical hand that's holding up the euro like China that's doing their best to hold it up or whether it's some other maybe market force or whether it's just the fact that Germany's strength and their commitment through the ECB and the Eurozone in total is they're committing all sorts of money to keep things afloat are keeping the euro at a relatively high, depending on what currency you're looking at, is interesting. And you have to look at, well, what would happen if there was Greece coming out? Initially, you'd probably say, well, that would be chaos and the euro would fall apart. But in a way, if you take the weighting of Greece out and you consider the fact that if Greece goes back to the drachma, their own currency, and they exit, and there'll be a lot of mess and a lot of problems for a lot of places, but doesn't that mean the euro would actually strengthen over time? Considering the fact that the weakest link is out, and if you take that weighting of the valuations of the countries and depending on their, or considering their strength, it seems to me that the euro actually gets stronger. Just a thought. Now, at the same time, we're seeing that Greece obviously is in a pickle. We're seeing news headlines after news headlines over the weekend into last week, all of a sudden switching from, hey, Greece is here to stay, we're not giving up on them, to we're prepared for Greece to exit the euro. That's what the recent headlines are from major players in Europe. So I think that what they're doing is they're prepping us for the inevitability of Greece actually coming out of the euro. The problem with that is, who's next? Spain is looking very weak, very problematic. We're also seeing, you know, the add-on effect that if Greece does come out, do they default? Do they just tell them, hey, give them the big bird and say, you know what, we are not going to be paying our debt back to you and pulling in Iceland on the Eurozone? So this gigantic amount of money is going to really weigh on things for a while till there is a resolution. And the problem is until the government in Greece gets together and forms a dominant party, or at least they come together with some kind of decision of how they're going to work together, we're not going to know. And there's going to be this uncertainty. And you always know what I say, that the markets hate one thing the most of anything. It's uncertainty. Investors don't like uncertainty. Now, the Fed will come out and talk about how they have the monetary tools next week to make sure that there's, you know, no problems in the U.S. when it comes to all this. And, you know, you're going to hear all this babble and this ridiculousness. But that's what we're really going to be facing with right now is what's happening with Greece and the inevitability of them coming out. We've talked about it with Das. We've talked about it with other people. And we've had Mark Faber on the show, by the way, in the past. So this is kind of the things we're looking at. Let's switch over now to the next discussion we're going to have. And I think it's important we have a little bit of a conversation about what happened with J.P. Morgan, because the big issue right now is whether or not J.P. Morgan broke any rules and whether or not they were involved in trading or was it hedging? Big issue right now, trading or hedging? Because if it was hedging, well, they failed miserably in what they did, taking a $2 billion loss and maybe another $1 billion if they can't get rid of this thing, because there seems to be an illiquidity with this particular instrument that they're dealing with. And a lot has to be flushed out before we really understand what happened, because the news is pretty thin, even though they've been ahead of the onslaught, with Jamie Dimon speaking recently on Meet the Press, which we're going to listen to in a second, and with a lot of the other aspects of this whole debacle. But one of the things that you have to look at is this whole idea of, is this a trading issue that they had? And if it was, is this going to play right into the hands of the Volcker Rule players who want to limit banks, which I think is a good idea, to not having prop trading? Or was it hedging? Now, I keep saying that because I want you to listen carefully to what Jamie Dimon says in this interview.
So how did this happen? There were reports about questions that were being raised about the kind of hedging that J.P. Morgan was doing. Did you ignore warning signs about this? Were you in denial about it? Did you just miss it?
You know, I think somewhat, first of all, there was one warning signal. If you look back from today, there were other red flags. That particular red flag, you know, we made a mistake. We got very defensive and people started justifying everything we did. And, you know, the better thing in life is to say, maybe you made a mistake, let's dig deep. And the mistake had been brewing for a while, so it wasn't just any one thing.
The immediate question, the SEC is looking into this. Did the bank break any laws? Did it violate any accounting rules or SEC rules?
So we've had audit, legal, risk, compliance, some of our best people looking at all of that. We know we were sloppy. We know we were stupid. We know there was bad judgment. We don't know if any of that's true yet. Now, of course, regulators should look at something like this. That's their job. So, you know, we are totally open kimono with regulators, and they will come to their own conclusions. But we intend to fix it, learn from it, and be a better company when it's done.
In the simplest way you can, what was what you called a screw-up? What was the screw-up?
Yeah, so banks either make loans or invest the money in securities. We have a huge securities portfolio. We're a big bank. In fact, the securities portfolio does have an unrealized gain of $8 billion. But in how we managed that portfolio, we did lose $2 billion trading. And in hindsight, we took far too much risk. The strategy we had was badly vetted. It was badly monitored. It should never have happened.
So here you are, Jamie Dimon. You've got a sterling reputation. Why? Because people say he knows how to manage risk better than anybody. You're known as the guy who ably led J.P. Morgan Chase to the worst financial collapse since the Great Depression. How does a guy like you make this mistake?
You know, anyone in business knows you always make mistakes. So you just said that about me. I've never said that. If you read all my chairman's letters, we always talk about what we did wrong. Always what we did wrong, how we can get better. No one in business doesn't make mistakes. And so this is a terrible mistake. I'm not making an excuse for that, but I know we're going to make mistakes. I just, you know, when you're in this kind of job, you hope they're small and few and far between. This one is far too big.
But if this happened at J.P. Morgan Chase, which really understood how to manage risk, what about all the other banks out there? If somebody else had made a mistake like this, would we be again talking about too big to fail and taxpayer bailouts?
Yeah, so that's an important point. So we support getting rid of too big to fail. And it's very important that, and this is not going to even remotely, we're going to make money, we've got tons of capital, but we support too big to fail. We want the government to be able to take down a big bank like J.P. Morgan, and it can be done. We think Dodd-Frank, which we supported parts of, gave the FDIC the authority to take down a big bank. And when it happens, I believe compensation should be clawed back, the board should be fired, the equity should be wiped out, and the bank should be dismantled, and the name should be buried in disgrace. That's what I believe. We need to put that back in the system, and we're working with the regulator to try to get that back in the system.
But you've been the most outspoken advocate, saying there's too much financial regulation, that Washington doesn't understand it. You oppose the Volcker Rule, which says just this, that a bank should not be betting its own money to perhaps enrich itself. It should only be trying to manage or minimize losses.
Yeah, so that's all completely untrue. And by the way, if anyone wants to go check the documents that I actually write every year in my chairman's letter, which I write myself, I get help, we have supported 70% or so of Dodd-Frank. We supported resolution authority. We supported higher capital liquidity. JP Morgan always had higher capital liquidity. That's partially to make up for mistakes and problems. And, you know, obviously it's a tough economy. We support an oversight committee. We supported some of the compensation, new compensation rules, but we already followed most of them. So we support a lot of it.
Is it me or did he definitely say that this was trading? He clearly said that this is a trading error, and I think that's going to be really scrutinized dramatically. There's already SEC investigations looking into this. And when you look at the, I guess, the initial reaction and the initial discussion of what happened when this news story first broke, there was a discussion that it was a hedging strategy over in London. Already a lot of the executives that are involved in this are going to be fired. We saw the news on that. And you have to wonder, wow, is this really going to be a situation where there's going to be the request of Jamie Dimon to step down? Already he's being asked to step down from the New York Fed. And this whole aura of excellence that has been put upon J.P. Morgan, and in particular Jamie Dimon, for the ability to manage the risk of a bank, taking a $2 to $3 billion loss, which, you know, in its entirety is a lot, but when you look at it on a relative basis to the earnings, it's not terrible. They can make some of that back up. But, you know, I just wonder how much more scrutiny is going to be put on the banks, particularly in an election year, because of this. Now, Simon Johnson, a professor at the Mass Institute of Technology and a former economist at the International Monetary Fund, talked about the outlook for J.P. Morgan and the discussion after the loss on a special report with Tom Keene on Bloomberg's television this week. Take a listen to this.
How are you?
I'm very good. You called a couple hours ago for the resignation of Mr. Dimon. He's a leader of 261,000. Why should he resign? Is this screw up his fault per se?
Well, I think in any other industry, Tom, when a company makes this kind of mistake under the direct supervision of the CEO, a CEO who's known for being careful about these kinds of investments, that CEO would resign, or the board of directors would move to replace him.
Let's look at this note. You published on Baseline Scenario a while ago. We've got some Johnson's writings here. Folks, let's bring it up. This debacle review is a fatal flaw, not in J.P. Morgan thinking, in Bernanke thinking. The lessons from JPM losses are simple. Banks have become too large and complex for management to control what's going on. The breakdown in internal governance is profound. Have we gone anywhere from 2007, Simon, or are we only beginning with this loss to confront too big to fail?
Well, I think too big to fail has become much worse since 2007, 2008. In fact, the defining moment is the collapse of Lehman. It's after the collapse of Lehman that the government and the Federal Reserve really decide to back up these banks. How could Jamie Dimon make this kind of loss, keep this position open, which is what he says, if it were not for the fact that he's backed by an unconditional credit line from the Federal Reserve? That's what it means to be too big to fail in modern America.
And if you think about that, that is really the heart of the matter, that there is an unconditional backing for the banks and they don't think they'll fail, and taking an unreasonable amount of risk really doesn't matter. When you have a economy that's set up as it is, where basically free money flows into the banks and the banks know that they are sustainable and able to get at any amount of money because the inability for government to come in and do the right thing is apparent, then why not take the risk? Why not take on as much risk as you can? And if you fail at it, well, so what? You know, they'll come in and they'll rescue us. In other words, they haven't learned a thing, and we haven't taught them anything, nor have we put regulation upon them since the Lehman and Bear Stearns debacle. So here we are, 4 years later, economy has healed a lot, and banks have gotten back a lot of their gusto, a lot of earnings power. Big banks have gotten bigger. Some have gone out, but yet they have been some of the smaller ones out there. Nobody's gone to jail. And here we are once again with exactly the same situation happening, not by any other fault, but the fact that the banks took on too much risk once again, just like they did with the mortgage situation. Now, Europe, of course, is a different animal. They're still going through the same situation that they did, and it just never got healed. Our banks had the opportunity to heal, and all of a sudden now we have this J.P. Morgan blow up. Now, I'll tell you something, actually on the news, we went and took up a position of Morgan Stanley for a couple of different reasons. Now, this is a pretty aggressive idea, and it's a pretty a contrarian idea, but I want you to think about this for a second. You know, there's two schools of thought here. Either the banks are all doing this and they're all going to be doomed, or this was kind of a one-off or maybe two-off situation where the situation that J.P. Morgan put on and the position they put on was so large and so illiquid that when they had to try to either unwind it or when things went against them, that what happened is it created a big problem. Now, Morgan Stanley has some real problems also. One of the problems is that they're facing a possible two-notch downgrade by Moody's. They have exposure to Europe. And they have now this black cloud hanging over their head of whether or not they did the same thing or something similar to J.P. Morgan's blunder here. Now, if any of those things, any of those three things are true, perhaps the market has already discounted and priced that in. Think about that. If, in fact, any of the one of three things are not true, well, we know they have European debt, but what if they only get a one-notch downgrade? What if they don't have that kind of trading position on? And, you know, that's questionable because they can hide these things pretty well. Well, there's going to be a big rebound in Morgan Stanley stock. So while the sector now has a black eye and while there is some real problems out there, how much is already priced in to some of these positions? So on that, it was worth a trade. It was worth picking up a piece and being careful, watching where the stop losses are and looking to see if there's an opportunity and then, frankly, not holding on to it forever, but looking to exit it for a reasonable profit if it gets to that point. But at the same time, you have to look at there's going to be a lot of calls for a lot more diligence, a lot more regulatory oversight, a congressional panels. I mean, there's going to be a festivity of this going on now with the banks. And the banks now entirely, the commercial banks, the trading banks, the Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, not so much Capital One, not so much Wells Fargo, because they don't really participate in that. But the banks that have their own trading funds and do some of this, those are the ones that are going to have additional scrutiny right now. And it's possible that not all of them have done this. Just keep that in mind. Something to keep in mind. We're going to now listen to a quick conversation from Art Cashin. Art was also on our show about a year ago, a couple times, and what his commentary was and what the right on the floor from the New York Stock Exchange, what they're talking about this whole J.P. Morgan situation.
Sonny, on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, you know this man, Arthur Cashin. What the heck happened? Yeah. J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon, was a spokesman for anti-regulation, essentially, saying we've got everything under control, perceived to be the best managed bank, and now they come up with this announcement that they made some terrible hedge. What's the implications of this?
Well, there's two parts to the story. Number one, traders are bewildered. If it was a hedge, if you were hedging a position and the hedge went bad, then the position should have done well. So where's the profit on the other side? So if it was a hedge, it clearly was a poorly constructed hedge. It wasn't hedging anything. And number two, the concern is, where was this? There's a lot of gossip around that they may have been a dominant force in this particular instrument, and that when they stopped doing what they were doing, leaving a vacuum, the market went against them because they were the only one.
But what's the larger implications? You got guys out there who are arguing this whole too big to fail thing has got to stop. We've got to find a way to break up the bigger banks. The Volcker rule should be implemented, more strictly enforcing limits on trading activity. Don't you think this is going to give an impetus to those people making these arguments?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, the timing couldn't have been worse. I mean, having hearings on the Volcker rule and whatever, it's tough to regain the credibility with this making headlines all around the world.
All right. And with all of that, the market is up today. Could you explain that on, what, better than expected PPI? Why are we up today?
Well, I think the wheels didn't come off the locomotive, okay? The financials went down, but they didn't go into free fall. But more importantly, there continues to be hope in Europe. The people in Greece are working as hard as they can to form a coalition government to prevent the guy from the far left from getting another election where he might become the dominant force in Greece.
That's a good point.
So Art Cashin is also talking about how the big question of the day is whether this was a hedge or this was a trade, because there's a lot of things that don't make total sense. And again, we're going to be hearing a lot about this, but there's going to be a real black cloud and a black eye on Jamie Dimon. We'll see, because you know, one of the things that has happened over the years is that the CEOs of these companies that have the responsibility, ultimate responsibility, of understanding what's going on with their company, nothing's really bad happened to any of them. You know, we've had a few here and there. We see that recently for Avon, the CEO was taken out after their bad play. And we see that just this weekend, Thompson, after the Yahoo situation with his resume, he quit. We're also seeing that Green Mountain Coffee, there was a trading situation where he exercised some shares that he shouldn't have to cover a margined position, a leveraged position, and he was taken out from his chairman role. So there's a lot of things that seem to be happening from a investor advocacy standpoint, and that's a bit of a change right now, and that's actually a very healthy change. It looks like the markets are, in a way, starting to sweep up their own crap, let's put it that way, and starting to clean house a little bit more than they have, because before they just let things go and all that, and maybe they're getting to a point of being quite fed up with the shenanigans that go on a daily basis with companies. So we'll kind of keep watching that. I think that's really going to be a trend that we're going to continue to see, and we're going to find that CEOs are not going to be as loose and liberal with some of the artistic talents they've had in the past to shape, twist, and make things look a little bit different than they were. And the transparency request by markets is going to be heard loud and clear. And with the new rules that are going in, and possibly the Volcker rule, and, of course, Sarbanes-Oxley, which is already there, Dodd-Frank, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out, but it may put a new level of requirement and a new level of fear, possibly, in CEOs to actually do the right thing. Could you believe that? Interesting. Now, let's switch over to the whole discussion of the economy for a second. Lashman Alchison from ECRI, and he's called a recession. He has some very good tools that he uses, his growth index and his weekly index to look at, you know, what's happening on a coincident and a forward basis. And he's been right more often than he's been wrong, which is pretty good to say about an economist, about when a recession is called. Now, he called first for the recession back in September or so, I think it was, that a recession is imminent in the next 6 months or so. Well, we've obviously passed that point right now. But let's take a listen to what he said recently on a Wall Street Journal interview.
We've been here before, haven't we? We've been here before. Now, you say we are still going to have a recession. You made this call last year. You made it on this show.
Sure.
And we didn't have a recession. Everyone was anticipating one, but we didn't.
Well,
the numbers as they've been released so far this year,
right?
And
I'm just asking it that way to make a point, which is that typically it's about half a year after a recession begins before you get your first negative GDP print, and it takes something like that or a Lehman or a 9/11 for people to kind of be like, whoa, wait a minute, maybe there's a problem here. 9/11 happened 6 months inside of a recession. People didn't really believe it until they got kind of hit over the head. Lehman, likewise, happens 8 months inside of a recession. And just a few weeks before Lehman, we had a GDP release. And you know what happened? I'm going to tell you, okay? In August of
2008... What are you going to remind me? I'm going to remind with you.
In August of 2008, you had a huge revision up to the second quarter from 1.9% to 3.2%, Dow rallied 200 points, thinking a recession had been averted, yet you were 8 months inside of it and just Lehman woke everybody up soon after. So that's my point, is that you don't recognize it right away.
Sure. Okay, so what is the data that you can see right now?
Sure.
Obviously controlling for those weaknesses and observations.
Yeah.
What are the things that you see now that lead you to this belief?
Great. Coincident indicators. So forget about leading indicators and forecasting for a minute. Let's just look at the data we have in hand of what has recently happened. And we see that the broad measures of output, broad measures of sales, income, and now jobs. Jobs had been a laggard. They hadn't turned down until February. And now jobs, they're all turning down together. And that is the sign of an economy that is not reviving, but rather slowing. And we're slowing from such a low pace to begin with, that a recession is basically at your doorstep. And on the income part, that's the really nasty part. Right now, for 3 months, we've had income growth so low that it is lower than it was at the start of each of the last 10 recessions. So the 10 earlier recessions started with income growth higher than where it has been for the last 3 months. That's
which
consistent.
Which has been part of it, supposed to have been a recovery. Yeah. Now, can the Federal Reserve do anything about this? I know that a lot of investors are looking and saying, oh, the Fed's going to save us. Don't fight the Fed.
I find that it's so ironic, right? Yeah. We're all free marketeers. We're all capitalists, right?
Yep. We are. There are some people out there who aren't.
A lot of people are, free market economy has endogenous, inherent business cycles in it, which means ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic that we think that the Fed or other policies could just stave off a recession indefinitely. And you see this happen, that hope builds every time when there's some concern about the economy. Mm-hmm. If we just did this, if the Fed just did that, then there's not going to be a recession. And I have news for you. We have 222 years of business cycle history. We've had 47 recessions in that time, I know the hope is that if we print enough money, maybe the Fed can stave off the 48th recession. But the odds are not in our favor in terms of the economy.
All right,
the market's different.
We got to go, but to me, the main question here is, perhaps you're right. Maybe the recession numbers will bear themselves out this summer, but end of the year 2012, we're going to have this great congressional battle over taxes.
Yeah.
How does that figure into your view?
It gets a little, it's just weird the way the calendar works here. If we're right and a recession's starting here or in the second quarter, first or second quarter, it takes about a half a year to get recognized. That lands you right in the middle of the election and the debate you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So the odds are that the population's going to be wise to the recession during this discussion.
So Lashman is obviously sticking to his recession call, and now I guess it's moved forward a little bit. But if you listen to what he said, he talked about how you don't really know that you're in a recession until you're in it. So when we look back on it, if there is a recession call, it would probably, if it was to be now, we wouldn't see that for another quarter or so, and then they'd step it back to the second quarter of 2012. So he would be right about that, just to kind of throw that out there. But, you know, when you look at the overall level of the activity and how things have turned down, you have to admit at least that there's been some kind of a slowdown here. And while we're not being hit directly and proportionally the same as you would think due to the European slowdown, the fact is that we are seeing a lot of things wear off, and that's due to the fact that we have really no stimulus in the system, that aside from Operation Twist. The Fed is not out there actively lowering rates because they can't. They're not out there actively doing QE3. Now, there's a lot of calls for that. PIMCO's Bill Gross says that, yes, we need QE3. Now, let's say that, and let's think about the fact that, of course, he wants that because he runs bond portfolios, the largest in the world, and that would be really good for the bond portfolio. And the hope is that, you know, you continue doing this, get one more blast of QE, drop bonds again, and then you kind of blow them out. That would be the way to look at it. This is only about a year after he said that rates were going to be actually going up. Doug Kass, on the other hand, is really talking in the book about how he's long TBT and short other bonds, so he's actually effectively short bonds, thinking that interest rates will actually climb higher. And they've been kind of doing their own thing to kind of level off here. How much lower can they go? It seems like it's impossible to go any lower, but I've said that a year ago. I said that a year and a half ago, and we saw a print of the 10-year, 187, well below the 2% line. That would be the line that would be, thinking things are pretty bad, and people are running into bonds, but they're still doing so at very low interest rates. So the big draw there still. Let's skip over. We have a few things that we want to talk about. One of them we want to talk about is some listener questions. I want to talk about the Facebook IPO. I want to mention that we're going to have, keep your eyes and your ears open over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com and at triggerpointresearch.com. We're going to have a special webinar. It's going to be limited to the first 100 people that sign up, and it's going to be all about finding support in resistance zones and how on the Trigger Point Research side, we're looking for those sweet spots, and we call them fast zones, where stocks will either, break up really nicely or break down. And, not working on the insides, not working on the consolidation zones. We're going to show you some charts. We'll show you some things. So keep an eye out for that. And when I'll tweet that over at Andrew Horowitz, one word. So if you want to get that first line, make sure I'll put that right up on there first So you can come sign up for it. First 100 people, and it's going to be free. And also, if you want to check out the Discipline Investor, will be on there as well. Now, let's talk about the Facebook IPO, because that's of interest to a lot of people. And, you know, I think not only to a lot of people, probably everybody. Not everybody that's a trader, an investor. I mean everybody, because it is being looked on by teens. My kids have talked about it. And I don't think it's just because I'm in the business. I think that there's a real interest in this whole thing because they live and breathe Facebook. Facebook is the go-to. Now, I was with Barry Ritholtz last week. I talked about this on DH Unplugged. I was with Barry Ritholtz. We had a nice cup of coffee, spent some time together, and we talked about a piece that he wrote recently because Facebook's S1 talked about somewhere upwards of, I think it was 800 million users. And that's pretty exciting. That's a great opportunity. It's a big user base. Yeah, the biggest. And 800 million users is something that was looked at very carefully by Barry and his team. And he actually found that it was more like 150 million users only, because if you strip out all the people that are maybe, you know, duplicates and people that just come on to maybe sell the likes and sell products and things like that, there's really only about 150 million users. And he wrote a really interesting piece on this, and I think he put it also, I believe it was in the Washington Post, he wrote about this as well, and on the big picture over at Ritholtz.com. I think that there's a lot of hype going into this. The company's going to be valued at about $100 billion. Somewhere they're going to price the IPO at, I don't know, 25 to 30. We'll leave that range. Probably going to price at the high end. That's what's going to happen by the end. And Mark Zuckerberg is going to still have about a 57% interest in the company, so he'll be running it, which is very unlike a friendly kind of shareholder offering. But we're seeing that, you know, as what it is. And I would venture to say there's going to be a lot of interest in this, even though there's a lot of people that are really poo-pooing this whole thing. It's not going to be a Groupon, but I don't know how great this is going to do moving forward. Already they're complaining about lack of advertising as their mobile is growing dramatically. Very difficult for them to get any kind of traction on the advertising when it comes to mobile like they have on the website. And the question you have to ask yourself is, it's a very simple question. Is this a fad? I know right now you're saying it's not. I got it. I'm with you on this. But is this a fad? Is this the MySpace? Is this, you know, something that's going to stick? Facebook has a lot of stickiness. It has a lot of opportunity. The question is, how much revenue can they actually produce from just advertising? Right now they're producing somewhere about, I think, $1 billion. But if you take that, you know, you're talking about 100 times sales. If the company's valued at $100 billion, 100 times sales, that is probably a record. Well, it's not a record. Back in the old days, in the internet days, back in the 2000s, 1999, obviously companies were valued a lot higher because they didn't have any sales. It was just opportunity. But there's a lot of people that are taking a piece of this, and I just wonder how much is going to be unloaded very quickly. I would venture to say if you're going to play this and you don't have an inside price on it, I would do like we always do on IPOs, and that you can grab a small piece if you want to. And then what happens is if it does come down, you wait for it to come back above the high price of the IPO offering, you know, when it comes out on the market. And that's when you build onto it, whenever that happens. And don't be early. You could kind of, you know, take up a little piece here and there, but don't keep buying it on the way down. We've seen how that happens. Now, I'm not suggesting Facebook is going down. Let's kind of get that straight. I'm not, you know, don't send me all sorts of hate mail and saying I hate the company. That's not the case. I'm just trying to be objective and come up with a strategy if you're looking to play the Facebook opportunity. And that's going to be on Friday, so there's going to be a lot of action. There's going to be a lot of eyes on that, and you got to realize that probably the rest of the market is going to be just staring directly at that in kind of a zombie-like fashion. So a lot of the other market participants will probably be just left on the side with very little volume because everybody's going to be watching what happens with that. Just like when the playoffs are on or the U.S. Open is on or some catastrophe happens, the volume on the markets dry up. And that's probably going to be the case on Friday. So keep a watch on that. And if you want to buy a little, okay, I guess you can do that if that's something you really want to do because you really love it. But think about the fundamentals and watch the chart carefully, because it's going to move very, very quickly. And try not to do it on emotion. Have a game plan written down of exactly how you're going to play it beforehand. I don't think we can actually short the shares because they're too new. It depends on, you know, depending on who you have as a broker. So if you want to play it on both sides. But right now, if you're looking to get just long the position, again, what I would do is be very careful and wait for it eventually to kind of go through its adjustment phase after the IPO comes out, and then grab it on the top if you after it goes back above the highest price in a couple of days or a couple of weeks or whatever it is. That's the best place to play IPOs because you got all the players shaken out that are going to sell, and now you only have the buyers that are really looking to pump this thing up. All right, let's get to a question that I have here. I got, and by the way, the reason why we're doing the webinar is because we got about 10 or 12 emails in this week asking about Trigger Point Research. It's become very popular, by the way, and if you have not checked that out and subscribed to it, for the amount of money that you have to pay, I think it's a bargain because you get instant text messages and emails on breaking up, breaking down, bounce alerts, updates on a regular basis of where the stops are, what's happening. You get a kind of a secondary place to find trading opportunities. And all these trades are designed to be less than 30 days in total duration at the most. So just go over to triggerpointresearch.com/subscribe. But that's what we're going to have the webinar, because a lot of questions coming in about that. We're going to talk all about kind of how to find those support resistance points and exactly what this is all about. Okay, so this is a question from Scott. I don't know where he's from. But he says, I just listened to your podcast number 194, which is, that's a while ago, a couple years ago, I guess, a year and a half ago. One with Ed Griffin, and you said that people could email a question. So I would ask this. If the central bank sets interest rates at about 0.25% right now, how would they just allow the rate to float to whatever the market wanted to be? Could you explain how the rate would be set or how it would be determined? Is it simple supply and demand? Is it how much people want to borrow versus or compared to people who lend? He says, I guess that it would be institutions and not individuals. I'd love to hear your answer. I've read Mr. Griffin's book, but he does not really respond to emails much. I probably get too many of them. All right, Scott, here's the thing. I think that when you're looking at interest rates, there's a couple of different rates that you have to really consider. The interest rates set by the Fed are set by the Fed, and they can't change unless the Fed changes that rate. So interest rates could change on individual bonds. They could change on treasuries. But the discount rate and the Fed funds rate don't change. And that's the rate that's really involved with the banks. The banks. That's what they can effectively borrow on an overnight basis and utilize to fund their businesses. So the Fed is trying to keep those down because they want the banks to refund refund themselves or get their balance sheets back in order, back in good stead, so they can have cash on the books and then lend it out at a higher rate and get the differential. That's how it works. Now, the market has the power to bid up the rates on bonds if, for example, let's take Spain as an example. When Spain's economy is in trouble, when it looks like the government's not able to repay, well, what can happen is that investors will say, you know what, supply and demand, I don't want those bonds. I'm not buying those. I'm going to put them somewhere else. I'm going to put my money somewhere else. And what happens is because there is a lack of demand, the prices go down and the interest rate moves higher. Now, that may not have anything to do with the fact of where actually you see the official rate by the government. The official rate by the government is set on the Fed funds rate and the discount rate. Again, that's separate from bonds. So you need to put those two things aside and differentiate them because the markets cannot push the Fed funds rate in itself. It would be more of a Fed decision, growth of the economy, outlook, and how they want to fund the various financial sectors. So I hope that answers that question. I hope. And of course, you can send in your questions to askandrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's see. What else do I have to talk about? There's some interesting rumors last week. Monster Worldwide was talked about LinkedIn and a separate partnership is going to actually go in and possibly buy them. And then it was said they're not and all that. Monster Worldwide was up. Be a pretty good fit, actually, if LinkedIn picked them up because there's really a great opportunity for, a relationship there. I thought that was something interesting. We actually put out an alert on that last week. The Greek government, we mentioned that there's still no... There's no resolution here with that. We're going to see Fed minutes next week. We're going to see some Fed talk next week, so keep aware of that. It seems like the Bernanke days have been really good days for the markets, and I want you to realize that we're in a strong downtrend. The market trend indicator that we use is still in a strong downtrend, but of course what follows that, can't get any lower than a strong downtrend, what follows that is sometimes, quick or in a long term, eventually an uptrend. Now you have to have a sustained uptrend in order to really start pounding on the longs, but right now, you know, you have to realize that there is some liquidation distribution going on in the markets in a big, big way. Big way. The other thing I want to mention is that we have to really focus in on this week how China reacts to the fact that the government is becoming a little bit more lenient on the reserve requirements. And this actually goes back to the question of Scott of you know, how the government can regulate the flow of money in and out of banks. One of the things they can do is say, hey, you know, you have to have a certain amount of money to back up the loans that you put out. And when they lower those requirements, more money floods into the markets, potentially, because banks are more, they have the ability to lend out more money with the same amount of money they have in the books. Now, you have to question whether or not this is a good move or not. Right in the middle of all of this that's going on, the banking sector in China, we talked about this with DAS a few weeks ago, is having their own little trouble due to the fact that there's a lot of loans that are really in bad shape. But what we're seeing is a continuation of kicking the can down the road in not only Europe, America, Latin America, but also in Asia. In fact, there was a decree by, I believe it was South Korea, Vietnam, to just renew all loans and just let them roll over. Don't default on anybody in the large space, in the large loan space. That's interesting. So they're basically saying, you know, we hope that things are going to get better. And again, nobody fails. Not setting up a really good precedent for the future. But with the ability of now more money to flood into the China markets, there is some benefit there, but there's also some question. How bad are things really in China if we still see a lot of problems coming out of the housing sector and with their economy falling down, the government is willing to take the risk of reigniting inflation that they have been so diligent at bringing down. We saw the CPI, if we want to believe this number, you know, in the mid threes, 3.5% last week, which is again lower than has been, and they've been done a good job at bringing down inflation. Is this a good time to all of a sudden take your foot off of the brake and apply the gas to it in China? I mean, I guess it makes some sense because there's a lot of really negative headwinds going on around the world, and the fact is that they're really suffering from an export problem due to the fact that, you know, Europe is really not ordering as much, and there is a global slowdown that clearly is occurring. So, you know what? We'll have to see how investors react to this because it is one of those things that could be taken either way. I would take it as it's a good thing because it does push more money in the markets short term, but we've seen this already three times so far over the last several months, and it really hasn't done anything to help out their economy. So these half a point moves, this half percent move to push money back into the economy and off of or unrestricted banks from lending hasn't really been working too well. Okay. Next week, Frank Curzio is coming on. I have some questions for that fella. And we have lots more that will be on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You know, you could sign up for an email daily alert from thedisciplinedinvestor.com. When you go to the site on the top right, it says sign up for email and all that. Just right on the right-hand side in the top. If you put your email address in there every day in the morning at about, I don't know, 7 o'clock in the morning, you'll get kind of a summary of all the things we wrote over the last day. So you can keep up to date with it instead of just going to the site. And we also have RSS available as well. But we have also the simple way of getting tweets. Just sign up for Andrew Horowitz. One word, Andrew Horowitz, and you'll get all of the instant information that comes off of the Disciplined Investor as well as some commentary on a regular basis. That's all about all we have for our little virtual guest-o-rama. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope that you're sticking around. Do me a favor. Go over to iTunes and leave a review. Can you do that for me? Take a minute. Go over there and say whatever you're going to say about the show, you know, and we'd like to hear what you have. Got a good number of reviews there, but I'd like to get some fresh ones in there to find out exactly what you think and not just put the stars in there, but write a couple of lines about what's going on in your mind, how you like the show, how you don't like the show. You know, if you don't like the show, don't write it. No, I'm just kidding. Write whatever you want to write, and I'd like to hear it. Tell me some ideas that you have, some things that you liked in the past, etc. Until next week, I want to thank you for joining me. Be careful. We are in a strong downtrend right now. We'll update that market trend indicator when it occurs on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you'll be the first to know. If you have any questions, of course, you know what to write. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And finally, if you want us to manage your money, let's make it simple. Just go over to the website, check out the virtual tour, $50,000 minimum. We go long, we go short, depending on the market conditions. We'll buy into stocks, we'll sell stocks, we'll use options. You'll find all about this. And if it's time that you're like really confused, you don't know what's happening in the markets, you don't want to invest, you do want to invest, you're fed up, whatever it is, you want somebody to handle it, that's what we're here for. Simple. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.